This week there's a ton to discuss. First up, just two really short follow-up things to last week. The first being, we discussed those new iPad Pro ads where they show like really basic, you know, white background, people using iPad Pros to do creative work. And the end claim was that everything was shot on the iPad, edited on the iPad, and like all iPad Pro all the way through. And we said, like, you know, the obvious thing to do would be like release a behind the scenes video. And they did, which was kind of, is like pretty neat. Is this what you would suspect? Like a lot of other gear involved, like this big special rig to hold the other iPad and this big white table. And, but it's neat to see like how messy that behind the scenes really are, with the end being so polished.
And I'm sure if they were using a quote unquote real computer, they probably could have got away with some more, you know, iPad on a green screen. They replaced the screen after the fact. They're not having to do it all in camera on an iPad. But that doesn't bother me. Like, I knew there would be some concessions on how it was shot just to make it happen. But the fact that you can even get that far is it fulfills the point, right? Like, it's not a backing down of the claim if you can actually get stuff done, because there's all the stuff that's on the screen is perfectly legitimate, and then they've also gone the extra mile and then the behind the scenes. And again, like some previous commercials, they even had older iPads in the mix. They were using the 2017 iPad Pros for some things, as well as the newer ones as well. So they like doing this thing where they kind of show a mixture of both. And of course, they still sell the 10.5-inch iPad Pro, which has the home button and stuff. So it all lines up, and it's cool to see them just do the... I love the behind-the-scenes videos. They're almost better than the real ads.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about like what software would be limited from the iPad. I think the thing I looked at the most was like that if they were using a dedicated camera instead of like the iPad as the camera, then it would maybe be easier. But yeah, it's neat. I wonder how the behind-the-scenes video is shot. I'm sure that was like shot like traditionally, like, you know, not on iPads, but just however you...
Yeah, how far down the chain do you recurse?
Right. And the other thing is the shot on iPhone photo challenge that Apple is holding, where you submit a picture to via email or on Twitter, Instagram, or Weibo, and Apple picks 10 winners and uses the photos that were shot on iPhone in ads later this year. There was a little bit of debate about whether or not Apple should be compensating the winners with like a licensing fee, and we had a very heated debate where, well, no, we didn't. We just agreed that you know, it was fine not to, and that your point was that whatever the amount is, people would want more, or people would complain that it wasn't high enough. Well, Apple's solution was to change the rules and say that they will pay a licensing fee to each of the winners, but it's an undisclosed amount. So that way, no one can say it's not enough. You just don't know how much it is.
Yeah, and if you win, you'll be under non-disclosure, so you won't be able to say. So.
Yeah,
and they did have a nice statement around it. They were like, Apple strongly believes that photographers and artists should be paid for their work, and the winners will be paid a licensing fee.
It was the Taylor Swift Apple Music thing all over again, where...
it really was.
Yeah, it was like during the free trial, we were not going to pay artists, and then it turns around, they do. Yeah. Much smaller scale, but...
But nice that they addressed it.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know... No complaints here. And then the first big story this week is, it's really funny, like last week before I could even edit and release the show, iOS 12.2 came out. Like we learned that it was coming. And I just remember last week we discussed like we're finally out of the betas, and like we'll probably see new betas soon, but like, you know, next week at the soonest, or next month maybe. And it was like the next day instead before we could even put the show out. But iOS 12.2 is in beta, watchOS 5.2, tvOS 12.2, and macOS 10.14.4 or something like that. The Mac
5, I think.
0.5. Yeah, the Mac versions are up there. Yeah, 0.4 beta. That's what I'm running right now.
So, okay.
Yeah, and there's a lot of new stuff here. So... Guy Rambo discovered evidence of Apple News magazines like graphical assets showing internal seeds of testing what looks like the texture purchase where Apple bought the magazine subscription business. And we assume that's going to be pulled into Apple News as like a pay Apple monthly and you get access to magazines. Well, that's being tested internally, and you could assume maybe it's going to come with iOS 12.2.
Yeah, and the kind of background graphic shows some magazines like Vogue as examples.
Yeah.
And some food magazine stuff. It's unclear if they're actually signed and sealed deals or if, you know, whoever was testing it internally just made some placeholder artwork with some magazine covers, for instance.
Yeah.
Similarly with the name, like, it seems to be called on this pre-release thing that we found, Apple News Magazines. That seems to be the branding. Again, I would not be surprised if that was placeholder naming as well. Like, the team that's making the software isn't the team that ultimately decides what the service is called. So maybe eventually it will be juiced up a bit to sound different, because I think Apple News Magazines is weird. Like, it could just be called Magazines in Apple News, for instance.
I think Rambo found references like Apple News Premium as well.
Which
could be, because one of the things I'm curious about is right now you can like pay the Wall Street Journal or New York Times or other publications directly and then unlock your subscription within Apple News. And the texture, I think, is just magazines. But there also been talk of like combining magazines and news.
They've definitely mentioned newspapers.
Yeah. So I could see Apple News Premium being magazines plus news. And maybe there's tiers within that. There's like magazines or news, but if it's just magazines, then it's just texture, but integrated. And if they do news, then I think that would be different than what texture offers today. But Apple News Premium sounds more like the product than Apple News Magazines. And I do think like it looks very placeholdery for sure, you know, and not, you know, finished.
Although it could be coming sooner than we think, potentially. If it's in 12.2 beta at this stage, maybe. And the text even says this is an internal Apple test. So it can't be too far out. So a launch before WWDC doesn't seem impossible.
Yeah, and this zoom back a little bit, it seemed, you know, you would, based on the past, guess that iOS 12.2 could come out around like March, at the latest like April, but this is a...
Yeah, I mean, they've already said the spring because of the pre-announcement of the AirPlay 2 stuff at the beginning of the month. Yeah. They said all these features coming in the spring, and this beta includes with the AirPlay 2 stuff, so
yeah,
March, February, you know, March, early April, that kind of time frame.
Yep. Next up in the beta is Apple News coming to Canada for the first time. Right now, I think Apple News is the US. Is it UK and Australia, or is it just US?
It's UK and Australia as well.
UK and Australia as well, okay. And so for the first time, it's going to come to Canada, and that will include bilingual language support because it's going to be a mix of English and French. And it seems like it's going to be an experience where whatever your language is set to, if it's in Apple News, it translates it. I think is what they're describing. So, and partly in the beta, there seems to be some issues with like where, you know, I think 9to5 Mac is like not in Canada right now. I'm not sure that you can really control it. So, and on the Mac, I don't think the news app is there in the beta yet, but, it's officially coming and as part of this release, at least.
So. Yeah. And they confirmed that on the investor call that it will be out with the next update. Cause Apple News is mostly just reflowing content from the web into, you know, slightly nicer mobile design formats. And it's largely algorithmic, but the front page features and editorial spotlights, they're all done by people in Cupertino in some office somewhere. They decide what the top stories are and they update them and then they send out push notifications. Mm-hmm. And so when they're adding another country, it means they're committing to having real humans run the front page in Canada, so you have Canada specific news, because the top stories in the US and not the top stories in the UK. They have different you know, different teams of people, essentially editors for those front pages, and then beyond that you can obviously just go and subscribe to whatever's in there separately, and then the stuff below top stories and videos featured by the editors and is all done with algorithms that supposedly learn your kind of interests and service stuff that way.
Like the UK, Australia, and then Canada won't have the like 2020 election coverage that the US will have. I think that the royal wedding worked in the US and that was big, but most coverage is pretty specific to the country. So I think they've also got, they want to make sure that they've got people staffed locally who are experts in what's going on. So, you wouldn't have someone from the US be the expert in what's happening in Australia. So,
and texture, for what it's worth, was actually available in Canada as well as the US.
Oh, nice.
So pre-acquisition, it was offered there. So maybe that the Apple Magazine service is also launched in Canada at the same time, which would explain some of the rollout here.
Yeah, yeah. All right. And then the wallet app gets some UI tweaks. And then one of the main things is right now it's possible to see transaction history, but it's a few taps down, and now there's some new stuff there. So what's the design like now?
Yeah, so it's, I don't think there's any new features. They just kind of changed how it works, because now you like tap on, you go into the wallet app and you tap on one of your bank cards and it rises up. And before it would say hold near reader or authenticate with face at that stage. Whereas now it shows you your last transaction in this kind of like floating bubble, and you can tap through and it'll show you the map and the pricing. And those features were always available in previous iOS releases, but nobody ever found them because you'd have to click on like the little I button and then go down and click transaction history, and then it would be listed there. And so they've surfaced the most recent transaction immediately, which is really nice. And when you tap through, there's also a new kind of like bubbly round, everything's rounded rectangles of interface UI of the same thing that you've had before. But the thing I like about it the most is when you do press on the card from the main screen, you get this animation where the kind of the name of the title, like the wallet, just fades away into the done button. And similarly on the right hand side, the plus button fades away into the more dot dot dot. And it's kind of really slick animation, seemingly disconnected from any new feature. Because normally when Apple does like an update to an app, there's like a motivation, because seemingly with news, obviously they're ramping up to launch the magazine service, and maybe that's why Canada and Texture, etc., etc. But it doesn't seem like they're going to roll out any new wallet features anytime soon. They've just kind of, whoever was on that team has given it a bit of a UI touch up before, you know, just in a random month for the thing. But it's welcomed. It is nice.
They're really excited about Target and Taco Bell getting Apple Pay, and they're going to give it a new UI. Yeah, the inline music stuff in Siri is neat, where you, I guess, ask to play a song, or maybe even if you ask what song's playing, and haven't seen that in the use, but maybe. But at least there's now an inline player for music controls whenever you ask Siri to play a song, right?
Yeah, so the same, basically what you see on the lock screen when music's playing, that kind of widget with the play pause and the slider, that will actually show in the Siri interface now, whereas before if you said play Taylor Swift, it would just say playing Taylor Swift as text and then an open music button. Whereas now it'll play Taylor Swift and it shows the now playing interface right in line. So you can adjust volumes, skip tracks, move along. And they've also got some, maybe you also meant kind of recommendations as well. So you can switch between some alternatives if you didn't get it right first time. So it's nice UI stuff like that that is good to see. Obviously Siri has many problems and things that can be worked on, but you know, visual interface is definitely one of them.
Sure.
And I think one of the things that Siri stood out by when it launched all the way back in 2011 was its kind of distinct interface. Because in the good old days, each of the widgets had custom appearances. Yeah. You'd have like the weather widget that was like a pool tab, and it was all like bluey colors. And each widget were being, you know, skinned very differently. You could have like the movies widget with like a carousel over the top, like you'd see with neon lights and everything flashing around. And in the iOS 7 and later years, everything's kind of been pulled back to such a degree that it's all, you know, just kind of like plain white cards. And I think this is kind of the start of, you know, adding some more richness back into the thing by having, you know, integrated music. And I'd love to see that happen in other places as well, because like Siri is voice first, but when you're using the iPhone, you've got that massive screen there. You might as well do something with it. And if you look on like what Google's done, they've brought stuff where you like go into their assistant screen and they show you stuff proactively before you even ask a question.
Right.
And I'm guessing that at some point they will make Siri do that as well, where you just kind of launch the Siri UI and then it has, you know, your weather and your upcoming calendar in like an immediate proactive view regarding you having to like ask for it and see each card individually. And maybe this is kind of the start of that, because Rambo said he looked into the code and there was a massive kind of back-end restructuring of how the Siri interface is run. But obviously today, there doesn't seem to be too many UI changes apart from like the addition of music here, mm-hmm. but maybe it's the foundation, so something more substantial.
The inline music player is the groundwork to having like Siri work with Spotify and other things. And then that goes to the iPod.
That'd be nice.
Yeah. And then on the Mac, there aren't many visual changes there, but we see the Stocks app, which is the Project Marzipan port from the iPad, but on the Mac, it gets an app icon change, which is the iOS app icon. But it appears to be a mistake because you can launch like the application on like, look within it and see the old app icon for the Mac and it kind of shows like with the Marzipan weirdness, there's so much code shared between iOS and the Mac that in this beta 1 version of Mac OS, it's actually pulling the iOS app icon. So, I think that gets fixed in the future, but it's something we saw.
And then, yeah, I hope they don't actually go down the avenue of making all the Mac icons round rectangles. It'll be terrible. Even just making all the Marzipan app icons round rectangles will be terrible in its own. Yep. The Stocks app icon that they chose isn't probably the greatest Mac icon that's ever existed, but it does fit in with the design of every other icon, like the tilted rectangle on that angle. And putting a round rect with the iOS icon, they just it doesn't fit on the dock or doesn't fit in the system. So I'm pretty sure this is a bug because you can even make it like glitch out and weirdly crop itself. Yeah. So I think this will be fixed in beta 2, but yeah, I definitely wouldn't want that to ship.
Right. And the next thing is in Control Center, the, what started out as an optional tile for the Apple TV remote as like an extension of the Apple TV remote app. In iOS 12, they started adding it automatically if you have an Apple TV on the network, I believe. And now it's been redesigned and it will also not only control Apple TVs, but HomeKit TVs. And, it's got a new look. And so on the iPhone, it's like a full screen thing. And on the iPad, it's just a very large remote, but not quite full screen. Do you know what's different about it for the Apple TV? Besides just kind of the way it looks, but like functionally, is there anything changed there?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think there's now a button on the now playing control. Like if you're playing video on the Apple TV and your iPhone knows that you can tap it and then launch the remote from the lock screen, which is neat without even doing Control Center. And then there is the behavior where now if you turn your phone off in the Control Center remote was open, you turn your screen back on and it's still launched even over the lock screen, which is nice because like that was one of the advantages of the Apple TV remote app is that like you lock your screen, close, turn it back on, the remote app is still there. But in Control Center, that would, before this beta version, it would dismiss. That could be a bug, but if not, it is a nice feature, right?
And I think it is actually meant to be intentional, even if right now it's a bit glitchy, because when you launch the full screen remote, it puts the home indicator back onto the screen to kind of signal to you that it's a new modal sheet that you can dismiss. Whereas normally, if you're just opening a Control Center widget, the home indicator isn't displayed.
It's a positive change because...
It's really nice because obviously you play something. If you're using the Apple TV to control the remote, you then watch the show, which means you put your phone down. Mm-hmm. And when you pick your phone up, you're back on the lock screen and you're back to square one. So simplifying it like that is really nice. And just making it fill the screen versus being the inset rectangle makes it a lot easier to use because I'd find when you're using the iPhone remote, it'd be like the Siri remote, but a lot worse, where you'd kind of put your finger in the middle and start panning around, and you'd very quickly run off the edge of the on-screen palette, the panel that's on, and you just dismiss it. So you'd always have to basically be looking down to check that your finger's in the safe zone, whereas now when you make it an edge-to-edge full-screen experience, on the phone at least, you don't have that problem. So you can just much more easily scroll around with the Apple TV control, and you have the buttons at the bottom.
Yep. Now, we'll talk about HomeKit TV stuff in a moment, but I've been able to have my TV operate as a HomeKit TV would. And so that also puts my TV as a candidate for the new remote app. So I can switch between Apple TV, which is just like the new UI, or TV remote mode, which is like specialized for a TV. And so instead of being like a D-pad, it's got virtual, but like it's like a virtual D-pad that you can't swipe around, but it's like,
instead of like a virtual trackpad, it's a D-pad.
You tap, and it's kind of weird. Like it feels like it should be able to interpret swipes instead. Like if it's a swipe in one direction, decide where it is, because
the Apple TV remote on the virtual one or the physical one is kind of continuous gesture where you can keep swiping, it moves along.
Yeah.
But you can simulate a D-pad with discrete swipes, like an all the way swipe up, yeah. swipes up. You just have to go like 1, 2, 3, 4 or whatever.
And it looks like a D-pad. It looks like the swipe gesture-y one, but just like with suggestions on it, but it's not. You've got to tap the specific areas. And I find that to be like, that's the only thing my complaint is that it is confusing to like have muscle memory of like Apple TV is swipe gestures, and then TV is a very similar UI, but you've got to tap. You got to like actually look at the screen and tap in a specific spot. And I've also found that I don't have a, you know, and this is with using HomeBridge to have the TV like retroactively have HomeKit added to it, and it's like the unofficial method. But I found that I can control the volume of the TV itself with the volume lock button on the iPhone in the remote mode, but there's no like UI for it. There's no like slider. So it's just like click the, and if I'm like playing audio on the iPhone, then it changes the TV and the audio on the iPhone. So that part's a little bit wonky, but that might just be that it's unofficial. And then aside from the remote UI change and in addition, Rambo did discover 4 new iPad models in the iOS 12.2 code. That's one of the things we looked for, is like there's a new beta. It's the first one to include code for these rumored devices. It also includes code for the iPod Touch. And then the same day, I think that this was discovered, that Eurasian database that has to have new products that are going to come to market entered into it before they're released, showed the same thing. So there's plenty of evidence now that iOS 12.2 comes out in spring. There's just maybe a spring event, but at least new products that launch with this being, you know, their version of software.
Yeah, just kind of what we predicted a couple of weeks ago.
Yep. And then the HomeKit TV stuff is really neat. Like, this is the first version of iOS that works with the HomeKit TVs that were announced as part of CES. It does have the AirPlay 2 stuff that they kind of showed off in like the AirPlay 2 for video page. And what that is like, you, if you have an Apple TV, for example, right now running the tvOS 12.2 beta, you can tell Siri on your iPhone to play a movie or TV show from your iTunes library that you've purchased on the living room TV. So you tell Siri on the iPhone, play the Tron Legacy movie on the living room TV. And without doing anything with your hands or the remotes, it just starts playing. Like, you know, if you have HDMI CEC, the TV will turn on based on the command, and then the movie starts playing, and you can change what's playing that way. And presumably when the HomePod gets an update, because it doesn't have a beta, it'll work the same way there too. So, it's useful. Like, that didn't exist before. And it puts the lock screen controls, you know, right on your iPhone or iPad with the little button that you can tap to, you know, go right to the remote section. So I found that to be really neat. And then in the Home app where you control HomeKit, we've seen Chaos Tien show off like what you're able to do. And then by way of like his work and the HomeBridge community's work, I've been able to have my TV finally work with HomeKit and using this like official stuff in terms of like what the UI looks like. And so now my TV is in the Home app, and you can include it in scene. So like you can finally have a movie night scene where it turns off certain lights and turns your TV on. And I've got an automation, because you can include it in an automation where if everyone leaves home, the TV turns off if it was left on, which is neat. And it's really nice, because speakers have been part of HomeKit since AirPlay 2. They don't get to be part of scenes or automations. You can like tap tiles.
Including
like,
the HomePod.
Yeah, including the HomePod. You can like tap the tile, like turn it on and off, but you can't do much with it. But with TVs, they can be in scenes. They can be in automations. You can tap the tile, turn it on and off. You can deep press it to like pull out the slider, or even switch inputs, which is really neat. Like we had this discussion at the beginning of the month about like, do you need an Apple TV if you have a HomeKit TV? And it's really enticing. Like my TV won't have the iTunes movies and TV shows app built in, but I can go to YouTube as the built-in app on the LG TV from the Home app, or even like from Control Center with the Home app tile, and turn the TV on, go right to the YouTube app, which has 4K, because Apple TV doesn't have 4K YouTube because of the format debate between between Google and Apple. And it's so neat. And I even saw like on my LG TV this week, I was poking around the settings now that I'm actually using it more, because I can control it from the iPhone. And there's like a an increased contrast mode. And what it does is it makes the background, like, instead of light white, it makes it solid black, and it's like true black, like on OLED, it looks awesome. I've been really enjoying that. The only thing is, like, you lose the swipey gesture remote stuff, and you have to do the virtual D-pad stuff. But it's been really neat. And like, I turned on Plex on my TV, and there's like an input for Plex now. And like, any app is that you can have. And this is with the Homebridge method. So I don't know how it would vary, like, if it was the official stuff, but like, the input list, you know, that they give you is like HDMI 1 through 4, live TV, and there's like the defaults. And then you can add in specific ones that you've got as apps. And so I've got YouTube Kids, Plex, even, like a fireplace app for the TV, you know, just like you have an Apple TV, even the browser. So I can, using the Home app on the iPhone, go to my TV's browser, and, you know, move around that way. And it's really, really, like, compelling. You know, I'm so glad that the Homebridge community is able to make this work as a backport, because LG won't have this working with older TVs, only 2019 TVs. Vizio is supporting, like, back to 2017, maybe even back to 2016, according to, like, one tweet from Vizio. And they're already doing a software beta where their customers can just give them their email, and then they can get access to, like, the pre-release TV software to match up with the iOS 12.2 beta. So that's really neat. And I was looking at Vizio TVs over the weekend. Like, I don't need to buy a TV to try this out. But they say any of their SmartCast 3.0 smart TVs will work with this. And I think it's at least like 40-inch TVs, and maybe, from what I was looking at, like 22-inch TVs that are like $120. Like, so it's worth looking into. Like, I almost want to, like, buy one and try it just to see, like, can you really spend $120 on a TV and have it work with HomeKit? Like, if so, it's neat. But
yeah, one interesting thing about that is that they let you, in the Home app, label the inputs. So if you've got generic HDMI 2, you could label that to your cable box, or HDMI 3 is your games console.
Yep.
And so you get, like, a readable name. Although right now, you can't ask Siri to switch inputs.
Right.
But considering you can name them, I feel like that will come. So you can say, you know, Siri, change to Netflix, and it will just change to Netflix on the TV.
Yeah. So I've been able to name HDMI 1 Apple TV. and so you can turn the TV, like, you could always turn the TV on and off with the remote app using HDMI CEC. But, like, now I can, you know, choose the input as Apple TV or change to another. Like, HDMI 2 is the soundbar, so that one is not one we use. And then 3 is the Nintendo Switch, and that's labeled. And then 4 right now is unused. But it's really, really neat. You had an idea earlier today, which is, can you turn off the HomeKit TV set from Siri on the Apple TV? And
yeah, or Apple TV turn off itself.
Yeah, because... So, and one of the parts of this is, like, the Apple TV gets the Siri commands from the iPhone and then presumably HomePod, but not any of this, like, turn it on, turn it off stuff, automation scenes. It doesn't get any of that. And so if you try to ask Siri on the Apple TV, like, turn off the TV, it'll tell you with the screen UI to press the sleep button or the whatever button to turn it off and sleep. And then HDMI CEC would, like, turn off the display if it works the right way. But if you say turn off the living room TV, or, like, whatever you've named it in HomeKit, then it actually works. Like, the TV goes off. It's just neat. I think it's too bad that, like, Apple TV isn't getting the same stuff as, like, what a HomeKit TV would get in terms of automation and scenes. Because with HDMI CEC, you could pull it off, but they're not doing it yet, if ever.
And I really hope that, like, a HomePod OS update that isn't in beta but comes out just lets you put it in an automation to turn it on and off. Because if you can do that with a TV, I want to be able to do it with the speaker. Like, good morning, and it just starts playing some music as well, because it's so annoying at the moment.
Yeah. So all in all, like, to go from a week where we're wondering when we might see the next beta come out to, like, this being the beta and we can actually use so much of this stuff. Like, I hadn't bothered to use – I had a Homebridge running on my Synology as, like – it was a bridge within the Home app, but I had nothing. I had no accessories under it. Because the old way was, like, you could make your TV a light bulb to, like, change the volume and stuff. Like, it was wonky. And now it's like it's part. The Home app knows it's a TV and it's a first class citizen. Like, there's still stuff that you can do, like make switches so that it's volume control and channel flipping. But if you don't want to do any of that wonky stuff, you can just have like a first class experience if you have, in this case, a webOS TV from LG. And then eventually, like when this stuff actually comes out, like around the spring. So it's really, really neat stuff. And
not a bad round of changes for a first beta.
This week, 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/happyhour. With all the recent news about online security breaches, it's hard not to worry about where your data goes. Making an online purchase or simply accessing your email could put your private information at risk. You're being tracked online by social media sites, marketing companies, and your mobile or internet provider. Not only can they record your browsing history, but they can often sell it to corporations who want to profit from your information. That's why we recommend taking back your privacy by using ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, or tablet. Turning on ExpressVPN protection only takes one click, and ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. Protecting yourself with ExpressVPN costs less than $7 a month, and ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar. It also comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you ever use public Wi-Fi and want to keep hackers and spies from seeing your data, ExpressVPN is the solution. If you don't want to hand over your online history to your internet service provider or data resellers, ExpressVPN is the answer. ExpressVPN also removes restrictions and creates internet without borders, defeating online content restrictions and censorship to deliver unlimited access to videos, music, social media, and more from anywhere in the world. And ExpressVPN offers unlimited bandwidth with a VPN that's built for speed and customer service over email or chat that's available 24/7. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/happyhour. That's expressvpn.com/happyhour for 3 months free with a 1 year package. expressvpn.com/happyhour to learn more. Our thanks to ExpressVPN for sponsoring 9to5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, Mayo, the next big thing this week is this FaceTime debacle that you cracked open, from what I see.
This was an interesting one.
Yeah, I guess it was Tuesday?
Monday.
Monday. Yeah, so Monday I was grocery shopping in Walmart, and it was after my hours. And I come back online to tell you about a weird iTunes bug I had, and you were like, well, this is weirder. Like, yeah, it is weirder. Yeah. What's going on with FaceTime this week?
Yeah, this was out of the blue. I was scrolling around Twitter, checking TweetDeck, and then there was this retweeted tweet that had about 2,000, I think, likes and about 1,000 retweets at the time. And it was this really short 15-second video, and it was, I can't remember the tweet text, but it was something about iPhones spying on you. And I don't even know why I clicked on it, because this stuff, every single day you get these conspiracy theories about, you know, iPhones are listening to you or Facebook apps are listening to you, all this rubbish. For some reason, I was like, surely 1,000 people can't be wrong. So I clicked on it. I watched a 15-second video, and it was an iPhone FaceTime calling an iPhone that was right next to it. And then they did a little thing, and then it seemed like the audio from the other person could be heard on the other person while it was still ringing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what? Okay. And so my first kind of expectation was that they were just hearing the echo back from the phone that was right next to them, because, you know, it's like microphone interference because they're so close together. But I thought, let's just try it. So I went and got my brother's phone, I called it, and it actually worked, and I was like dumbstruck. So all you had to do was start a FaceTime call to somebody else, and then as it was dialing, you add yourself as if you're starting a group chat, because you can swipe up, press add person, and then you type in your own phone number, add yourself to the group chat, and for whatever inexplicable reason, this would then let you hear the audio of the person that was still ringing.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have to accept, they don't have to decline. While it was still ringing, you could hear what they were saying through their phone. I was like amazed. But anyway, I wrote the story, and then after about 5 minutes of it going up, people started realizing that you could even go one step further. And if the person who got the phone call pressed the power button as if they were ignoring the call, then that would also start sending the video stream to the to the other person as well.
When the call rings, you can see yourself, and then I think when you answer, like the video gets like a different resolution, looks funny, and like it would make the video change. But like you'd have no idea that that's what happened in any situation, you know, unless you knew about the bug.
Yeah, and on the Mac it worked too, and on the Mac the FaceTime app rings for a lot longer than it does on the phone, because on the phone it's in your pocket, so after like, you know, 10 tries or whatever, it just gives up. Whereas on FaceTime on the Mac, we actually ring for a lot longer. And the quote-unquote spying of listening through the other person would last as long as it was ringing. Right. So if you have your Mac with the volume turned down, which I think a lot of people do, and you were just like not looking, you turned away talking to someone else in the room, you could literally listen to through the Mac for ages. It would just keep on ringing. You could keep on hearing. And they wouldn't be able to hear you.
Because we did a test where, like, after the story was long been published, and I just wanted to, like, try it on you to see if it worked, like, in the moment. And we were texting, and you're like, oh, it didn't work. And I was like, no, I can hear you. I thought you answered. It's like, I thought we were on a real call right now.
Yeah, there are even some people who, like, clearly whatever this weird add yourself thing confused the phone. Because for the most part, what we described is what happened. But for a few people, even after they pressed decline, they could still hear through the other end,
right?
Like, so there was some bug in the server that caused this to happen. And one like knee-jerk reaction people were saying that I saw was why is the FaceTime client sending your audio before you've pressed accept or decline anyway? And you just can't use that line of argument, because the whole point is it's a bug in an unexpected state. The recipient phone clearly thinks that it's already joined, so of course it will send the audio. There's that, you can't use that cause and effect of, oh, it must have been sending the audio, you know, forever gone by. Like, it doesn't work like that. Maybe it makes sense to do some investigation now and check that it doesn't start sending that kind of information ahead of time, but I'm pretty sure it's just, you know, the weirdness of bugs. And then you know, half an hour later, Apple puts out a statement saying they're aware of the issue and they're working on a fix. Yeah, not to us, but to everybody else. They're working on a fix to be released later this week, which in itself caused a furore because it was only Monday. So their expansive promise could have meant that the fix wasn't out by Friday. But then 2 hours later or so, they actually just turned the group FaceTime servers off, so you couldn't start a FaceTime call, a group FaceTime call at all, which obviously like abruptly stop this bug from being able to be exploited.
Yeah, and even that was weird because like you could see on the status page that the FaceTime server had an issue, which was self-inflicted. They turned off the group FaceTime part, and they had a description of group FaceTime calling is unavailable right now, ongoing issue. But like I then tested it and could still do the bug, and it's like They're trying to fix it, but did they? And it seemed to just be a propagation issue. Like for the next 24 hours, some people could still do it. And it seems by now like that it's solved by turning off FaceTime from a server level.
Yeah, as of recording, we're still waiting for the software update to patch the problem.
Yeah, yeah. And even then, like this whole time, there was a Twitter account with a non-real name. And then no photo, and the Twitter account was made like the end of last year and mostly had tweets about immigration. It was tweeting all the publications covering the story to say, look, my kid found this bug last week at least, and we reported it to Apple, and they were showing a screenshot of describing wanting to show the bug to Apple and kind of requesting, you know, is there money involved? Kind of, is there a reward if I tell you what's been going on? And you could see like part of a screenshot of like an Apple employee had responded and they were going back and forth, but you couldn't quite tell like what had happened.
They were fishing for a reward of some kind, which I don't blame anyone for, like money's great. But like if that was the only communication they had with Apple, you could understand why they didn't do anything about it, because an email saying I found a bug with the operating system, please pay me money, they'll get thousands of that spam like every single day.
And over the course of the following day, that person seemed to share more information with other people. And so it seems now that it's reasonable to believe that that person went through the process of contacting Apple. Apple said, use this form, make a developer account, file a bug. using the radar system.
Yeah, it's just this random lawyer.
Yeah.
In Arizona. Yeah, make a developer account, file a bug through there, and just a normal radar.
And so the bug in the screenshot that was shown was duplicated, which maybe just means that, like, I think you need to have a radar, like, it be duped before it gets attention, and like it's like a systematic thing. So like, maybe,
I think it's almost like flagging it, kind of.
Yeah. So like maybe Apple duped it to like make it go to the next level. But
from what I can glean is that they'll even dupe forward, in the sense that after they do like a customer report, they'll do an investigation and file a bug in their own privately, mm-hmm. that has like a more technical explanation of the problem, and then they duplicate it to like link it together.
Yeah, but at any rate, it does seem quite evident that Apple was aware of this last week, at least, and they you know, they could see it in the wild and know to work on a fix, but not turn off the FaceTime server. It was just, you know, the idea there, I guess, is Apple takes the position of, if we turn off the group FaceTime server, everyone knows something's going on. If we don't do anything but just work on it in our own time, then we can fix it. People won't realize there's always bugs to be fixed and up in software updates, and that's what would have happened. But another angle is that because it affected group FaceTime, which was added in iOS 12.1 at the end of October, this presumably was there since the end of October, so, you know, nearly 3 months. But once this was public because of, you know, someone posting on YouTube, people sharing on Twitter, then Apple couldn't have that, you know, security by, people not knowing about it. And so
security by obscurity.
Right. That was, their cover was blown. And so then they had to react. And then, and now there's like investigations into whether that, you know, they did the wrong thing by not acting when they knew. And it does look bad. The bug is like, you know, bugs happen. It's forgivable. It wasn't intentional. It's not like a policy of collecting data. It's a mistake that really embarrasses them. But you can debate how they respond to these things and,
I think clearly there needed to be more escalation of the problem.
Yeah.
Because it was probably filed away as a thing we'll get around to. And then nobody, like, because when you file a bug with radar, it goes to this kind of screening group that are not connected to the people actually doing the fixes at all, the engineering team. It's a dedicated group of people that just categorize and remove spam, etc.
Yeah.
So someone in there saw it. And then they probably didn't mark it with enough urgency, so then it just got put on a big pile of list and no one else saw it. Mm-hmm. Which is problematic, because this person's already been spoken to Apple support, been told to make a developer account to hold Smith here. Apparently she even spoke to somebody on the phone about it as well. Like, yeah. I think she did a good effort of trying to convey the severity of the issue, and obviously Apple either turned a blind eye or just didn't notice. Yeah. And if she reported on the 23rd, and it's going to take Apple 5 days to fix a problem, it would have been very likely that it would never have blown up and become a social media farce, because 23 plus 5 is 28, and the bug was like the 28th. So it was popularized on the Monday. So right. If they'd have actually responded quickly and immediately, they could have avoided all of the attention and all the problematic press. Because what they could have done is on the 24th, turned off group FaceTime and say, we are turning off group FaceTime temporarily to address a problem. Mm-hmm. And then on the, you know, they release the software update 3 days later and group FaceTime's back on. They say, we addressed a bug with security, blah, blah, blah. And it becomes a complete non-story. Apple just fixed a bug that was problematic and, you know, we get on with our lives. But it was their choice, you know, somewhere in the chain, not to act on it more quickly. And then they have to face the retribution, whether it's lawyers or just whether it's public opinion. Because realistically, I doubt anyone really got any actual spying off by abusing this problem. But I do think I do not dismiss, like, I called it a major bug in the headline because it's a major problem. And even just something as innocent as someone's calling you and you don't want to talk to them right now. And a common refrain when someone calls you and you're not interested, it's like, oh, I just don't want to talk to you right now. You know, maybe with some slightly harsher language. Like, that's a perfectly legitimate thing that hundreds of people do every day. And just for that potential that someone else could hear that, and that awkwardness alone is problematic. And then you have to compound that with it just reinforces, you know, all these devices are listening to you 24/7. Apple's privacy angle is clearly compromised because they don't have enough, you know, measures in place to protect this stuff. The iPhone's always listening to you, bloody blah, bloody blah.
Yeah, yeah. It may be. There was a time when I experienced a software bug with HomeKit where I would tell Siri to open Home, which is the name of the HomeKit app. You know, you can say open an app and it will happen. So I said open Home, and because my house and HomeKit was named Home, it would unlock the front door, and that was not the expected behavior. So I emailed Apple about it, and they took it very seriously, and have like the security team that you're mentioning contact me and say like, you know, what's you know, give us logs of this information, and they, you know, want to fix it. And I think they did like the server side fix could change how that behaved. And by the time, you know, we got around to sharing logs, it was resolved. And you know, you can see how it happened, but it wasn't good. The other issue is also HomeKit related, where a developer told us there is a bug in HomeKit where if with your email address, I can control, you know, your HomeKit accessories, see your HomeKit cameras, open your door, open your garage, walk into your home. All I need is your email address. And they told us that they had told Apple a month ago, and nothing was getting done about it. It was taking their sweet time about it. And so then we told Apple that we knew about it, and we didn't run the story immediately because we didn't want people to know about the exploit without there being a fix in place. And the developer told us, well, they could disable HomeKit sharing from the server level, and that would fix it. And then they can do a software update to fix it. And by our story applying pressure, they wanted to fix it within a matter of days versus like, you know, the next month or so. And that story ran, and we timed the publication with when there was a fix in place, which was the server. And then there was an iOS update that repaired HomeKit sharing, but it's like, that was and in both situations, this person named Devin seems to be attached to the email chain of like, we know about it, we're going through the process, but there's no rush because we don't think other people know about it. But it's like, there's just so many similarities of that, of like, there's a big bug, there's some process at Apple that makes it not repaired in time. And we don't know like what bugs get fixed daily or like, you know, they don't specify in each iOS update, like how bad the software you've been running was. They
do have a security, like what's new in security in this thing, but they're so abstract. A lot of those numbers, it's hard to actually know the, you know, the consequences of each of those problems. They could be really bad ones.
I mean, we saw the string that referenced the HomeKit problem, and it was in no way descriptive of like how bad it was. Like, so we could see the real story plus like the credit that they gave, you know?
And now that this issue has become like, you know, sort of mainstream news for the day, that this will be probably in the actual main description page of the settings, you know, when you do the software update, it will say addresses a bug with FaceTime.
Because the difference with the HomeKit story is we, because it wasn't on Twitter, it was something that a developer told us privately. We could work with Apple in the background, and then, you know, they wanted us to never write about it at all. And of course, we're like, well, no, we're not going to keep it from readers, and you need to fix it in any way you can. We were able to time the story going up with when they could break the server side and to fix the issue, you know, by breaking it effectively. It didn't blow up because it was like resolved as the story was going up, you know. And in this way,
even if it hadn't been like the problem with the HomeKit was serious, and you could unlock people's front doors with it.
But it's not every phone and iPad
and it Mac. Required some technical knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. The thing about this bug is that it was incredibly viral. Like everyone could do it to all their friends harmlessly, and immediately.
So you could prank it basically,
or
use it maliciously. And the whole thing is like you don't want the camera or the microphone that's always with you. You know, if it's the Apple Watch, you don't want the Apple Watch on your wrist. That microphone to be turned on without you knowing about it. And it's like this is I think the biggest problem is like the time it takes from Apple to know about it, to do something about it, and like the decisions that they make in between, and relying on no one knowing about it to give them time to fix it. You know, like, and it is, the whole team's dedicated to working on this stuff, like as it comes in, but it does seem to be a process of like, you know, what happens. You know?
Yeah. Like there are some bugs that happen and sprout up where it's like, surely the internal Apple QA teams probably should have caught that. Mm. This one feels more like I can understand why this particular edge case wasn't tested. And this one's more, you know, lay blame with the process and the machinery that of reporting bugs and getting, you know, serious problems fixed quickly, especially for, you know, layman customers on the street. Because realistically, if this woman from Arizona had contacted us, we would have been able to, you know, get a decent line through Apple a lot faster.
Yeah.
But because she actually went through normal channels, you know, the sanctioned Apple support channels of where you're supposed to do it, they even made her make a developer account to submit a radar, which is absolutely ridiculous. There needs to be like a bug reporter system that doesn't require, that you can just do with your Apple ID. Yeah, like, you shouldn't have to make a developer account to do that
stuff. Once you tell Apple at any point, whether it's Apple support on Twitter or like the Apple Music page on Facebook or an Apple employee, like in an Apple store, like everyone should have training on this. Like, if someone reports a bug like this, this is what you do as an employee who's been exposed to something like this. It's like, you know.
Yeah, you escalate it to a specific group. And yeah, yes, there are problems of scale, and there will, you will get 10,000 fakes for every real, but you know, that's why you're the $1 trillion company. Like, mm-hmm. you have to just pay for this stuff and just brunt it, because yeah, it's important. And if you look at other companies, they will pay you for reporting these bugs. Like, they have massive bug bounty programs that can span all sorts of categories, and they'll pay out thousands of dollars just for random glitches in Google Chrome, for instance. And you know, Apple's bug bounty program is kind of embarrassing by comparison. It's a closed group of people, and and even the rates for those people are a lot lower than the industry average. So it's problematic for a whole different reason. And you know, this woman definitely isn't in line to get a big payout here. Even if you had a similar bug on Android, you could report it to Google, and you actually would have got money for it. So there's a whole big, you know, shalamaram around all that as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not a great start for the 2019 year of stability, because obviously iOS 12 was meant to be the, you know, no bugs release, and that kind of advertising and marketing around it. And you know, it's January, we've had a pretty bad one. But again, like, bugs just, you can't stop bugs from happening. Right. Like, I'm way more annoyed with how they, you know, didn't deal with it effectively.
Yeah, and they said after the High Sierra issue, where you could type in root and enter someone's Mac with physical access, that they were gonna, I think, audit the QA process to make sure that never happens again. It's like you said, you can't not have this happen. Like, you know, these are humans working on software. There's gonna be problems, and what you can do is, you know, reorganize how you take in this knowledge once you have it, you know, and prevent the next one from happening.
And I don't think we've had an actual apology.
No, yet. not yet. And it seems like they're not quite finished with this yet. Like, you know, it's so far the only thing they've officially done is they've turned off Group FaceTime, and they've told like BuzzFeed and the New York Times about it. But there's been plenty of media coverage of it. And part of the thing that's tricky here is that for several hours before they turned up Group, you know, the server for Group FaceTime, the only thing you could do to protect yourself was turn off FaceTime entirely. And that was totally, like, if you were concerned about even somebody pranking you with knowledge of this, and you didn't want to be compromised in like an embarrassing situation where someone can call you and then hear what's happening, like, even if like you're in the bathroom or something, like, you just don't want that to be heard, then like, you turned off FaceTime. Like, that's what, and then there was the service off, the problems resolved, they've broken Group FaceTime. It's safe to have FaceTime on again if you trust it, you know? And it's like, I think it's fair, but it was that the story broke in the evening. The server fix was like much later in the evening.
And the initial Apple statement didn't mention they were going to turn off the servers in the meantime. So,
right, yeah,
you know, for even longer, it was like Apple's even responded and you might be exposed till Friday. So yeah, that wasn't a great situation.
So once like CNN picks it up, and they did, like, it was a major story everywhere. I mean, our specific coverage from breaking the story was even on the Tonight Show with Stephen Colbert. It was like 9 to 5 Mac. It was like quoting words that you wrote, which is really fun to see, but not with the circumstances. But like, you know, turn off FaceTime is simple to say. And it's like, you've got to be a little bit more technical to understand that they turn off the server, the problem solved for now, if you trust it, and you don't need to do that anymore. You can turn FaceTime back on.
But there will be a fraction of people that will never turn FaceTime back on again.
And when there's like an iOS 12.1.4 update, you know, probably on Thursday or so, because now it's Wednesday afternoon and we haven't seen it yet, you know, Thursday or Friday we expect, then you need everyone from iOS 12.1 to 12.3 to update to 12.1.4. So, and that doesn't always happen. Like, you know, we had people at 9to5 Mac who've been running 12.10, 12.11. Like, you know, you're just not in a rush. And so you've got to get everyone onto the safe version of the software before you can turn the server back on for Group FaceTime. So maybe you pad it out by a few days. And even then, like, there will always be a fraction of people that are susceptible. And, like, I saw people kind of downplaying this as a problem because you do have to receive a phone call, like the FaceTime call. So you can't just, like, tap into the microphone and camera. You've got to have that call first. So now we know. But before you knew about it, you didn't know. And it's like a phone call, even though there's a trail, a receipt of it, you know, it didn't work the way you thought it did.
And if you really want to be a criminal about it, you can make an Apple ID with an anonymous email address and do the exact same thing.
Sure. Yeah. And
but it doesn't like whatever the condition was to make it happen, your phone transmitting your microphone to somebody else without you saying, yes, please do that, is just problematic. Yeah. Doesn't matter what the invocation was.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
hopefully this gets resolved quickly. I would qualify this as a 2018 bug, though. That you know, we said last year on the last episode of the year or so that Apple had no major issues like this in 2018. I think we can call it 2018, and the 2019 just sees the effects of it. But that has been there all along.
Presumably, this has been possible since 12.1 came out in the end of October.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's been a wild one. And then we get to Apple's earnings the next day, right? Like one day later, and it never comes up on the earnings call. Like by this point, it's been fixed in part by breaking the server, and then we're just on to earnings, and the investors aren't going to ask. And like, it doesn't affect Apple's stock price. It's like it's a PR issue, but it isn't like a stock issue, I guess. I guess because it's fixed and. I don't know how it translates, but it never came up on the call. Apple reported the revenue of $84.3 billion.
Who could have seen that one coming?
Yeah, it's not analysts bragging about nailing the revenue because they guessed 0.3 higher than what Apple said. after revisions, when before their guesses were like way sky high, and it turns out, you know, Apple missed. And Apple acknowledged in the call, like, this was a revenue miss, even though it's, like, in line with what their revenue adjustment was when they had the numbers. And it was basically, like, a repeat of, like, the revisions letter, you know, everything's as expected. They went through the reasons. One thing that I found a little bit more compelling is that they called out Japan, where carrier subsidies are less common now because of regulation. And so we discussed, like, why are they talking about carrier subsidies going away? In the U.S., it's been the trend for years now, and there have been new promotions to kind of replace them. And Tim Cook mentioned, at least in you know, one market, Japan, which isn't where they put all the blame here, but that there's regulation preventing, I guess, misleading subsidies that consumers, you know, you get tricked into. And so that's just gone away entirely. And so that's a new data point. They also mentioned changes to pricing on iPhones, right?
Yeah, this was kind of gloss over in the call, but Tim Cook did an interview with Reuters about it beforehand. And essentially, Apple is going to change the way they price the iPhone to not be so connected to the US dollar. So at the moment, whenever Apple updates its prices, it does currency conversion of the, you know, $1,000 iPhone into British currency or whatever currency, adds on any tax, and then sells it at that price. Well, what Cook said is that some of the markets where they've had the weakest amount of sales for the iPhone are places where the currency fluctuation has adversely increased the price in those markets. So in quote-unquote some international segments, they're actually going to lower the price and disconnect it from US dollar and price them in local currency individually to, you know, kind of maintain what they were at the beginning of 2018, so about a year ago. And to do that, obviously, Apple is taking the cut somewhere along the line, because it still costs them the same amount to make the phone and sell it, and currency conversion isn't magic. Like, they'll be making less money right on each model. But clearly they've acknowledged that as a problem. And if you want to say, you know, Apple has pricing problems, well, there's one place where they are literally making the iPhone less expensive now.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Cook literally said that they're doing this in the hopes of helping the sales in those areas, in those regions. So it's like they think that they'll sell more iPhones and make more money by making them cheaper. You know, and that's fair. And you made an astute point, which is that in the letter in January, they called out markets, including the U.S., not including the U.K., where they saw iPhone growth, right? And so presumably those countries won't be the ones that see prices adjusted, but it'll be one.
Yeah. So the UK might win the price drop lottery.
And so you will not see the prices of iPhones go down in the US because the US is like the base price. It's everywhere else that's relative to the US by conversion.
Yeah, I think the first time we'll see any potential price strategy changes on the iPhone lineup for the US will be when the 11 comes out, because then maybe they put some down a little bit, put some up a little bit. See, but in terms of international, and they didn't say exactly when this is going to happen or which countries, so we're just kind of waiting to see some prices go down in Apple stores internationally.
Yeah. And before the ad break, there's one thing I wanted to mention. I forgot to mention two things from the iOS 12.2 beta section. And that's the first one. It's a small thing within screen time. Now you can customize downtime by day of the week, which makes perfect sense. And then Guy Rambo found references to AirPods with the Hey Siri feature and a setup user interface that he could simulate that references setting up Siri with your AirPods or iPhone by saying Hey and then Siri. So I think it's even more evidence that this iOS 12.2 update, which we assume comes out, which we believe comes out in the fall, or excuse me, in the spring, maybe around March, April, that these AirPods could be associated with them, which really excites me because mine are really aging poorly after a few years. So that was a pretty big story. So I wanted to throw that out there too. AirPods with Hey and Siri are in this code, it seems like.
Yeah, so some meaningful AirPods update in the first half of the year, potentially.
This week, 95 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Hair Club, because your confidence is important. And sometimes one change can make all the difference. Hair Club knows this, and they're inviting you to become part of the Hair Club family to see how getting the most out of your hair can change your life. Hair Club is the leader in total hair solutions. With a legacy of success for over 40 years, they're not new at this either. They understand the emotions you're feeling and know the questions you have. Whether you're looking to revitalize the growth of your own hair or to learn more about the latest proven methods for hair replacement or restoration, Hair Club's professionally trained stylists, hair health experts, and consultants will craft a personalized solution to ensure you feel your best and get the most out of your hair. Hair health can have such an impact on our self-esteem and self-image, but we can't always control how healthy our hair is, and we don't all have Craig Federighi's amazing head of hair. But it doesn't have to be that way. Go to hairclub.com/happyhour today for a free hair analysis and a free take-home hair care kit, all valued over $300. That's hairclub.com/happyhour for a free hair analysis and free hair care kit. hairclub.com/happyhour. Experience your hair and your life at its best, only with Hair Club. I'm certain you'll love the club. Our thanks to Hair Club for sponsoring 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour. I remember the last thing, something that happened a few hours before we started recording, which is our colleague Mark Gurman at Bloomberg published a single story with like a dozen tidbits about iOS 13, the iPhone 11, the next iPad Pro, like all kind of stuff. There's some smaller things about the iOS 13 that he mentions that are coming that we've kind of heard from him and others before, like CarPlay improvements. That's as specific as that gets. And that was kind of mentioned as part of iOS 12, but not happening because they wanted to focus on performance instead. So this is going to be that this year. Whatever it is, CarPlay will be improved this year. iPad specific home screen update, the thing there, we'll discuss that in a moment, but it sounds like the new home screen is only on the iPad, not on the iPhone. Tabbed app. So if you've got instances of the same app, you could have side by side. Maybe you could have multiple, like three, and then you tap through the different screens. So we'll see how that goes. And then,
I'll be interested to see whether the tabs are only in the same app.
Yeah.
Because obviously, right now you can do Safari tabs or Safari side by side, but you can't like
mix apps.
You can't have different tabs from different apps in one group, if you see what I mean. Which is something that the Mac doesn't do either, but obviously the Mac is proper windowing. So maybe on you know, the iPad, it makes more sense to be able to group stuff like
that. It would be disappointing if it's just like text document-based apps can do tabs now like they can on the Mac, you know.
Yeah.
You can then maps, you can have different tab maps. Like, it's pretty small, but and then the last thing is kind of, you know, what we've heard all along is or for a while is improvements to file management. So that may be an update to the Files app or like reading USB drives and that kind of thing. We'll see how that goes. Other thing is dark mode, which is this, I think this would be the first time we've heard about dark mode coming to iOS. You could assume it happens because they did the Mac last year. Now they're going to do it on the iOS, but we haven't heard it at least. And Mark's saying dark mode.
Yeah, it's definitely the first like legitimate indication for a dark mode this year. And I think this must be the number one feature request from all of the random like iOS concepts and mock-ups and, you know, like the fan, the stuff that people on YouTube and stuff just want to promote. Mm-hmm. Everything is like dark mode, dark mode, dark mode, dark mode, dark mode.
Yeah.
And it seems like they're finally going to deliver it.
And like many third-party apps have dark mode, like in a different way, that whether there's a gesture that you do or a setting that you tweak, and sometimes it's like true black dark mode, sometimes it's dark as well for like LCD screens, not just OLED screens. It always varies, but there's nothing system-wide like there is on the Mac. And I hated dark mode on the Mac like since it came out, but like for the last week, I don't know what changed, but I've been running it, and I'm now getting used to it, and I decided before this show I turned back to light mode just to see like, you know, what, and I didn't like it. It was like, this is what's wrong. This is terrible. Changed it right back to dark mode. So I'm coming on board. One of the things with this, the macOS update and the beta is in Safari technology preview for a while now, there's been a way for websites to say, I have a dark theme, and if the Mac is in dark mode, use it. And now that'll be in Safari that's built into the Mac, not just Safari technology preview, right? So that's an improvement. And it makes sense, like, that comes to the Mac and the web and then on the iPhone, I guess, and the iPad. So I'm excited for this, especially now that I'm coming
around. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see whether it's like a API in that it just lets the user pick if you want apps to be dark, do you want them to be based off sunset and sunrise or brightness, you know, or you know, like a just making it like a unified setting, or whether it's they're actually going to prescribe a new theme for the operating system in that way,
putting it in the screen bright, like, you know, where you can you go to this control center, you can change the screen by the slider, or you can deep press it and then you can get True Tone and night shift. Putting
it in night shift
would make sense to me. It's like part of brightness controls, but not like,
yeah, and so that would apply. That would apply for every app.
Right. And also interesting to see, like, if apps like stock connectivity that are already dark, they're not black, they're dark. Like, would those become light if you're using light mode? Or, like, would they have, like, a they're stuck in that mode, like, on light?
Yeah, well, stocks on the iPad is light interface. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, on the Mac, it can be dark or light. And on the phone, it's only dark. So the Marzipan apps definitely have light and dark accommodations already because they obviously have to work on the Mac.
Well, not the home Mac.
So I am really interested to see whether they go for a true black dark mode, mm-hmm. or whether they go for like the dark gray, dark blue dark modes, because obviously true black looks better on OLED when nothing's happening because you get the rich contrast. But I actually pick the dark modes when you get the option in apps that are more like, you know, dark gray, dark blue colors, mm-hmm. because the problem with all the current OLED phones, at least on, you know, the current generations, is that with true black dark colors, you get really, really bad motion blur, essentially, because mm-hmm. the black pixels of the OLED screen refresh more slowly when they're black versus when they're colored. So if you do like fast scrolling on a true black interface, it looks really like laggy or like wobbly. It kind of looks like jelly.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously Apple has to support its current OLED phones and its current LCD phones. So I would prefer if their system dark mode is a dark gray kind of theme.
It's going to be hard to make everyone happy here. I'd say that.
But yeah, that is you're not going to please everybody because I think what the, you know, the common guard and mainstream want is like true black OLED. Mm-hmm. But German in his story calls it easier nighttime viewing, which would probably support like a true black mode because then you're also emitting less light because the pixels on OLED don't have to be turned on.
Yeah.
But I personally would prefer it if it was like the dark mode that actually is, you know, just a dark color palette, not just no color at all.
Yeah, if you do true black, then it looks way worse on LCD. Like, it's, you know, a flashlight back there, kind of. And it, you know, the iPhone XR and the iPhone XRR, is not, they're not going to look great with like true black. And
or the iPads.
Or any of the iPads. It's like, and I don't use a lot of dark mode stuff on the iPhone yet. Like, maybe that'll change too, especially if it's system wide. But what I find to be a little bit challenging is in bright environments or like medium environments, true black, everything else is like, the black looks great, but everything else is like a little bit harder to parse and read. Whereas like less, you know, if it's like a dark gray or, you know, then it's a little bit easier to parse for me. And then oftentimes in like bright light, you've got to have white as the background to see. Although on the Apple Watch, it's like not an issue, you know, and we mentioned last week, the differences in like OLED types, but, yeah, it's neat. It's the first time it's been rumored as far as I've seen, and it comes from a great source. So,
and it would definitely make a lot of people happy, because whenever we do like polls on top features and stuff, everyone just puts dark mode at the top of the list.
I mean, even if it was just for the music app, people would go nuts, because like, so, you know, Spotify does it and Apple Music doesn't. So it's a, you know, yeah, I can't wait for that dark mode notes wallpaper, that paper material to come to the iPhone. The CarPlay thing's interesting because like I said, that was mentioned last year too. It was like, what was going to be an iOS 12, and then it's not because of, they want to focus on performance. And there was like a CarPlay behind the scenes change. They called it CarPlay Remastered. And it was just like, all you had to do was update for iOS 12, your app for CarPlay, and it took advantage of it and made it more reliable. Hopefully this is like new features for CarPlay, because we haven't seen that in a while. And I think there's more they could do. So,
and this, this wording here is more specific on the home screen redesign being more focused on iPad. So it's possible that, because obviously there's plenty of people that want the iPhone grid to change as well. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that actually won't happen, and you just carry on getting the same grid on the phone, and something more drastic on the iPad. Or maybe it's, you know, limited changes on the phone, but then it's radically different on the tablet form factor.
Yeah. Could see that, because the big phones aren't that big, but the iPads are.
I mean, I'll definitely welcome it for the iPad to finally break away from, you know, being a big phone, essentially.
I mean,
it's cool.
The 10.5-inch and up iPads are just silly with the home screen the same as like 9.7-inch and 7.9-inch iPads. Like, there's so much space between app icons, and like a folder looks silly. There's so much they can do. Or the iPhone doesn't have that problem quite as much. It's like, because it's made for the iPhone first. Although, again, you're not going to make everybody happy with this. iOS 14 will have a new home screen for this. Already getting there. And then Mark's report mentions the magazine and video subscription services. He says, you know, could come in an iOS update. And there's been rumors that the video stuff happens around April. So, again, like that sounds like this iOS 12.2 stuff, maybe. So, and there was a standalone report from Cheddar, which is like a CNBC-type channel where they cover financial stuff, and they're really good at technology wise at Snapchat scoops. But we've not seen the history of Apple scoops yet, but Cheddar is reporting that Apple's working on a game subscription service where presumably you pay Apple monthly, and then you have access to games on the App Store that are involved in this, and because they do a, you know, revenue share. Mark doesn't mention that, only in the Cheddar report, but it totally fits the bill of like something Apple would do to have a new revenue source.
So yeah, Apple's putting services on anything they can touch.
Yeah. Now, in Mark's report, he also has future iPhone details, including 2019 and 2020 iPhones. He says that Apple has considered, according to one person, USB-C on this year's iPhones, although it's not, I guess, decided or at this stage. The person,
or at least Gurman doesn't know which one they chose.
Yeah, that source doesn't know. But that's, you know, I think we saw like the Maka Takara say maybe USB-C, and then, you know, that was kind of it. So, and then the two render leaks from OnLeaks said Lightning. So, you know, we'll see what happens there. He corroborates the three lens iPhone rumor, saying that this year's 2019 iPhone, this is what he says. He said a third camera on the back of the 2019 iPhone will help the device capture a larger field of view and enable a wider range of zoom. So that's the first time that you're hearing what it will do, not just that it's there, but like what it will enable. He goes on to say,
isn't that contradictory?
Larger field of view, wider range of zoom.
I mean, I didn't understand photography as well as, you know, other people do, but if you're doing larger field of view, then surely that's bigger. Yeah, and zoom would be close up.
Yeah, I don't know. And it's this next part is why I have the quote in here, not just summarizing it. He says, Let's see. It will also capture more pixels, so Apple software could, for example, automatically repair a video or photo to fit in a subject that may have been accidentally cut off from the initial shot, according to the people familiar with the plans, end quote. So what he's saying there is, like, in your viewfinder, you see everyone, or you think you have everybody, but you actually forgot somebody, and you can – it's going to capture more than what you actually have in the photo. So, like, you got to edit the photo. Then you could scoot it over or zoom crop out. So it captures more than what the final photo shows you without editing. That's a new idea to me.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens there. The next thing is he mentions this laser-powered camera on the back.
This is the 2020 thing. Yeah.
2020 thing, okay. And he mentioned that this was initially for 2019, and now it's going to be 2020. But he says that the current dot method for depth captures 25 to 50, I think, centimeters of
depth. That's the front camera.
Okay.
The true depth on the front.
Okay. And he's saying that this will be a new laser method that'll capture up to 15 feet and be used on the back, right?
Yeah. So we've heard rumblings about this, the time of flight laser stuff. Even right. Quo's mentioned this in passing. Because right now the front camera on the iPhone obviously has the true depth system. The back camera has two cameras, which they use to simulate depth by working out the parallax between them. Mm-hmm. And then this would be like a proper laser scanner, essentially, that can project far out, much beyond like how close you hold your face to the screen, and you'd be able to like scan objects for AR. Like the use case I'm not quite sure about, but it sounds cool, I guess. scan something 50 meters away and do, I don't know what with it, but
15 feet away, which would be fewer than 15 meters.
Okay, like 10 meters or whatever, yeah.
3 meters.
Just scan the wall?
I bet it can do cool new stuff with portrait. Like, not have to be, maybe you can have portrait where you're not zoomed in with the zoomed in camera, and you can be much further away and have a nice portrait shot. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, and to be fair, it would make, because right now they have to do still quite a lot of guessing, even if they got two cameras to give, just you still see artifacting problems, right? If they have a more accurate dedicated laser, they don't have to rely on the software guessing as much. So you get more like realistic portraits at the very least.
Yeah, yeah.
And German says that was on the table for 2019, but it's been pushed back to next year. So
yeah, and then he also says that Face ID will be better. That's all he says about that. Okay, and then he says live photos will be improved from the new iPhone. He says this could be in software, I would guess, but he says that the live photo video capture will go from 3 seconds to 6 seconds. So I guess it's like 1.5 before and after to 3 before and after. Neat. It's a little bit tricky. Like, I guess you've got to have the camera open for longer to capture the full amount of time, but I guess live photos are going to be better there.
The other weird thing about that is that a lot of the time, like, it's almost worse if it's longer, because
put your phone down.
You're kind of flicking through and you're like, oh, you get like a second and a half of, or a 2 second flash.
It's
of context.
Cool in a photo shoot simulation. Like,
yeah,
a lot of photos, pick out the good one. Maybe one was in the middle, you know.
Yeah, although currently the live photo elements are low resolution, so right. it's not as nice. Hopefully they can do something where they can actually get higher resolution bits of those, you know, before and afters as well.
Yeah, and Mark says that the 2019 iPad Pro for this year won't be a thing this year, like, which I think we maybe predicted this last like in one of our recent episodes, where we say based on the past iPad Pro update cycle, they've done about every 18 months, and so rather than have one this year, there might be, maybe it'll be the 2020 iPad Pro, like earlier in the year, like in the spring. Well, he says that there aren't plans for an iPad this year, that there's going to be an iPad.
Aren't plans for a Pro this year. He repeats the 10-inch cheap iPad and the mini stuff.
This is his first time saying iPad mini that Quo had last year. And then he's also saying 10-inch iPad that's been rumored. So this comes from for this year. And then he says the Pro will be early 2020, and it might get the laser camera before the iPhones do. So iPad Pro in the spring of next year, and then the iPhones in the fall of next year. And he cited, I think, like iPads getting 4G LTE before iPhones did is like an example of how iPads can get stuff first. So
yeah, and they always get like, historically they'd always get the faster chips and stuff before the phones. And
yeah, well, it was a tough one last year or last generation for the iPad before this one. They did get the 1 TB. Well, they got 512 GB first, I think.
Yeah, they definitely had bigger storage options way before the phones did. Yeah. And it's like, great, so now we got the AR camera on the iPad, so we can you know that education event where they scan the frog. We can scan the frog from 10 meters away.
Scan a forest of deer and okay. Well, that was a quite. I mean, that was a single report, and Mark Kerman had a lot of information in that. It could have been an entire episode. So, and it came out a few hours ago. So we haven't, or, you know, maybe an hour ago, we haven't had a lot of time to digest it. But
it's funny how much of the software stuff is like a we've already talked about it before, because obviously it's half of it's all the iOS 12 features that are now back on the table again. And it's like what comes around comes around.
Yeah, and there's still plenty to know. Like, is the CarPlay improvement, and how does dark mode work?
And watchOS, are we going to get? I'm waiting for the watchOS report where it's like watch faces ? Again,
cause, sure,
or always on screen, like that kind of stuff. Feels I kind of been feeling that either of those are going to happen this year, like always on screen maybe, or the store, maybe not both, but it kind of feels time for one of those things to happen,
or sleep tracking built in.
Yeah, it's sleep tracking, as well.
Yeah. And speaking of the Apple Watch, there was our friend Kyle Seth Gray alerted me, and then you saw as well, that Apple's bringing back the Apple Watch Activity Challenge, and you guys are seeing this by the server, so it isn't like Apple's announced it yet, so it's kind of a scoop in that regard. But Apple's going to have a February Activity Challenge again, so if you have an Apple Watch, you'll receive an alert on February the 7th that if you close your exercise ring, 30-minute ring every day, from the 8th through the 14th, then you'll get an achievement, an award in the activity app, and some really cute new animating stickers, including a running exercise ring with hearts coming off of it. And the reason this is really interesting, they did the same thing last year, but they did not do a Thanksgiving challenge after doing one in 2017 and 2016, and they didn't do a New Year's challenge this year after doing one last year. So from what we could see, they broke something about how they deploy these. And because there was a Thanksgiving challenge queued up, never happened. And now they're back, it seems. So we're excited.
Yeah. And we did just have a WatchOS bug fix update come out not too long ago to the public. So would certainly line up that they actually fixed something. So now we can have activity challenges again.
Yeah. It's going to be awkward that they'll have a 2016 award for Thanksgiving, the 5K. 2017, but then they'll never be the 2018. And I think they had all the art and everything ready. It just didn't get deployed. So that's a weird one. But if you have an Apple Watch and you've done these before, or you were excited about trying to do them now for the first time, February the 8th through 14th, we'll have that around the world. So look forward to that. And with that being said, that's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach, and Benjamin, you are
BZAMayo on Twitter.
And you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.